Audi.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Why is it that with sparkling water, I'm always playing guessing games with what flavor I'm drinking? Is it citrus? Is it aluminum can flavored? Not sure. Sparkling ice, though, they really mean flavor. Like in-your-face flavor. Orange mango, black raspberry. Don't even get me started on the strawberry lemonade. Kiwi strawberry slid right into my taste buds' DMs last night and let them know who's boss. No subtleties there, and no sugar either. But it does have vitamins and antioxidants. Find sparkling ice at a major grocery store or club retailer near you. Sparkling ice. Anything but subtle.
Hello and welcome to the Big Travel Podcast. I'm Lisa Francesca Nand, and I'm overly excited about sharing the next guest with you, not only because she was brilliant and we got on really well, but also because I went to London. You remember that big place in the capital position of the UK? I went to London to interview her just after lockdown eased, the second lockdown, on the first day actually, and I went to the Natural History Museum and it was still closed to the public, so I got a little tour around the place and we went to a little room and then we did photos in the main hall underneath the big skeleton of the whale. And it was just amazing to be in London, amazing to be in the Natural History Museum. And I have to say, just wonderful. It's been great during lockdown to be able to, and you know, the whole COVID crisis, not just lockdown, but other times when we've had a lot of freedom, more freedom comparatively. It's been great doing Zoom interviews, but there's nothing I love more than actually sitting face to face with one of my guests. And you're going to hopefully love, I know you're going to love this episode as much as I do. So without further ado... Ella Al-Shamahi is an archaeologist, explorer and stand-up comic who's been described as the real-life Lara Croft. She travels the world exploring some of the most dangerous and remote regions. On this episode, Ella talks about her Channel 4 show, Jungle Mystery Lost Kingdoms of the Amazon, growing up in a conservative Yemeni community in Birmingham, getting herself into scrapes with terrorists, stolen DNA and its connection to Australian Aborigines, remote tribes driving big expensive cars, animals with charisma in Tanzania, attractive hunters in the Swiss Alps, and so much more. All recorded in London's Natural History Museum too. It's Ella Al-Shamahi.
As an adventurer, I thought a good place to start as an archaeologist and an adventurer would be your childhood, because you grew up as in a Yemeni family in Birmingham. Now that's an adventure in itself, isn't it?
I'm sure the Yemeni community would love me to say that.
Is there a big Yemeni community?
Yeah, there's actually quite a large community out there.
It's out there, just Birmingham. Birmingham, yeah.
Like any community, I guess, it's a complex community, there's pros and cons, but it's really interesting because it's a very, very tight community, which I love, right? But it is quite conservative, and so girls weren't really supposed to go out after dark. You know, it's like these things that you'd be told, like, oh, good girls don't go out after dark, good girls certainly don't go on adventures in the middle of jungles. Do you know what I mean? But one of the nice things, I think, is, I guess now that I've done it, I've seen a hell of a lot of that community kind of be like, yeah. And I mean, I'm sure there's some people that don't like it, but they haven't let me know, so that's good.
So how did it all start? I mean, you are from, like you said, quite a conservative community.
Yeah.
And you've ended up having this incredibly brave and adventurous career. How did it all come about?
I don't really know. I think, to be fair, as much as it's quite a conservative community, it's also a community that's really used to, sadly, playing with the strange dichotomy that's Yemen. Does that make sense? Like, Yemen, for those of your listeners who don't know it, it used to be, like, 10, 20 years ago, off the beaten track lists a lot, because it's absolutely stunning. But it's a lot of work, you know? Like, it is the landscape out there is exceptional. You have these incredible mountain ranges, pristine beaches with endangered turtles, and then you've got all this architecture, this ancient architecture. I mean, there's even a place there that's called the Manhattan of the Desert. You know, it's absolutely stunning, but it's you know, there's kidnapping risks, there's guns everywhere, there's landmines. It's, you know, it's a difficult place. And so I think I was always used to the idea of, oh, this beautiful place that's part of my family narrative. But also, oh, there's instability. So even though I was a girl and, you know, wasn't supposed to, like, you know, go out after dark and, you know, go swimming, and, you know, with men and all the rest of it, there were still parts of that background that really kind of played to who I am today. And then I guess I just, I don't know, you know, there gets to a point, I think, with most girls, if you see all the boys doing something, you're like, hold on a second. Hold on.
Absolutely, you know? I can do that. And how are your parents about that?
I mean, I don't know. There's definitely things today that they agree with, and there's definitely things today that they disagree with. You know, I think they'd like me to cover up a little bit more. But, you know, I think also they are just really, it's quite cute because I think they're really proud of me, but would like me to cover up a bit more. Yeah.
You've been called the Lara, the real life Lara Croft, and you know, I've looked at some of your outfits as you're trekking through the Amazon and everything, and they're not like your tight little shorts. You've just got a little vest top on and some perfectly sensible.
So it's actually it's really funny because you do think about clothing quite a bit for telly and stuff, and I had always dressed quite, you know, long sleeves, you know, quite kind of conservatively, I thought, to the extent that some of my mates would send me messages being like, mate, what, like, why are you so covered? And it was partly because I was like, oh, I want to be taken seriously. I'm a woman. I don't want to be. And then with the last two shows that I did, which one of which was in Tanzania and one of which is in the Amazon, I kind of had these really long discussions with people. And one of them was like, if I was normally in these places without cameras, I would be in string vests, not even tank top, like string, because that's how I, like, in really, really hot places that aren't really conservative, that's how I would dress. And I was just like, I think we just go for it, right? I think just there's a point when you just don't know what the right thing to do is, and you just think, you know. And to be fair, you couldn't wear shorts in the jungle. You'd get eaten. I mean, my arms were eaten alive. I think by the time I finished, it was like 50 or 60 bites on my arms. I mean, maybe at least it was horrible.
That's, travel is like that though, isn't it? You have to think about what you're wearing. And obviously if you're going for like a week on the Costa del Sol, you don't necessarily have to. But if you're, you know, going to a more conservative country, or you might be visiting a mosque, you know, you've got to wear things below the knee, you've got to take long sleeve tops. And the people who don't, I remember one time I ended up in the, well, it was just in the Maldives actually, so in a beach resort. But they took us to an island for the day, and I didn't know we were going to go to this island. And of course it's a very strictly religious country a Muslim country.
And were in your Maldives bikini being like, oh, hold on, it's wrong, it's not.
I thought we were going diving, so I literally was in a bikini. And I turned up there thinking, like, feeling like I'm one of these people that hasn't done their research. But that's not true. I am the person that would do their research, but I didn't know we were stopping off at the village. Yeah. I felt like a right idiot.
I mean, the thing is, we're all gonna do that. And there's been times when I've been like, oh, hold on a second, I'm feeling a bit uncomfortable. I think I actually might need to cover my head at this point. Or, you know, you just don't always get it right. But I think it's just being aware of it all and trying to. Whereas, you know, sometimes you see people and you're like, not only are you completely standing out, you're a kidnapping risk. Like, what the hell is wrong with you?
Well, you are. You're going into these incredibly, sometimes dangerous places. Yeah. You've been to all the far-flung corners of the globe. I mean, has there been times where you felt at risk?
Yeah, but also, like, not. It's interesting. So people always say this to me. People always ask, oh, what's the most dangerous, whatever. And I give so many different answers because it kind of depends on the time of day. And that sounds really weird, but it's because I think I've been quite lucky in that the most dangerous stuff hasn't happened to me. And the other stuff at times felt nerve-wracking, at times didn't feel nerve-wracking, if that makes sense. And I think it's interesting. When I talk to people that travel a lot, especially in places like that, I think they kind of know what I mean, which is that unless you actually get kidnapped, or you're actually held at proper gunpoint, sometimes a bunch of guys around you with guns feels nerve-wracking, and sometimes it just doesn't. And sometimes when you reflect back on it, you're like, oh, that was proper hairy. And other times you're like, oh, that was funny. Oh. Remember Ibrahim? Oh.
Pointing his gun at me. What a guy. Yeah. So who was Ibrahim? Was there an Ibrahim? No. That was just the name of
it. It's funny because I get so many questions. I have to kind of like really kind of go, oh, you know what? But I mean, you know, there's definitely been times where there's been, you know, people have looked at you way too long and they've had way too many AKs on them. But I think mostly you just try to not even get into those situations in the first place. So mostly it's about kind of having, this is going to sound really obvious, but having a really good team that knows how to blend in, when to get angry, when to not get angry, and maybe don't get angry that much. And, you know, that local knowledge is brilliant, like local fixers who are often journalists, or you know, they're often like really impressive professionals, making sure that you've got one of them that at least that's really good on the team. So you're just avoiding, like, one of the basic things we do is we look at a map and we identify which tribes will be hostile on that map, and we identify which terrorist groups operating which parts of the map, and then we look at the team and we look at, like, it's really kind of a bit awkward actually, because it's like, what are your surnames? Will they be a problem for any parts of this map? Also, what do you look like? Do you look like one of the tribes that's going to, like, do you know what? And it's all this stuff that we go through so that we just try to not find ourselves in the worst situation. And touch wood, so far it hasn't happened where it's, you know, an actual crazy situation. But yeah, I mean, you know, I think maybe if I had kids I'd reflect slightly differently. But I guess because I'm single in the childhood sense and gung-ho, it's, there's a different attitude to it.
I think maybe I'm sitting here thinking that maybe danger is a bit of an abstract concept until you're actually in it. I can only liken it to when I used to ask my nan about stories of the war, when they were living in their nice little house on the Wirral and being bombed, you know, in like your semi-detached house in the great swathes of UK that have that sort of, you know, Victorian housing, and they were being bombed, and she just said, well, you just get on with it. And if you look at us now, you know, we were talking about, like, you know, you've had your worst scrapes in London, really. Yeah, we were chatting before we started recording. And we're sitting here in the middle of global pandemic. This is the first day that both of us have been out in after a month of lockdown. Yeah. We're out. The shops are open today for the first time. We're sitting here in the Natural History Museum, which is quite exciting because it's closed to the public. It's actually opening tomorrow.
Yeah.
And maybe our kids or the younger generation will say to us, well, what was it like in the global pandemic? I hope they will, and it's like a thing of the past, not like, God, what was it like at the beginning of the global pandemic all those years ago? But we'll just say, well, actually, we just got on with it, didn't we? Just get on with it.
And I think that is 100% it. I think when so my nana's a Scouser, and she's exactly the same. She's got these wartime stories, and you sit there sometimes and you're like, that sounds traumatizing, but she's just like sits there barrel laughing about it all, and you're like, oh, okay. And I think people will look at COVID, hopefully, you're right, hopefully it's not the 100-year, like, you know, the 100-year war, like the 100-year pandemic. Jesus. But hopefully they'll start reflecting back on it, and they'll be like, oh, what was it like, blah, blah, blah. And I think a lot of the time, I think the headline, I guess, for me is, you know what, my cousins, family friends, colleagues work and live in some of these war zones. And you know what, they go to university, they have kids, they have weddings, proper weddings, like massive things, then get on with their lives. And yes, they are used to bombs being dropped. Yes, they are used to that instability that's all around them. And they just kind of, they do manage it. It doesn't mean that they don't have a hard time with it, obviously. And I think for me, I'm just like, oh, you know, I've been lucky. The worst hasn't happened. And I just try and avoid it.
So Yemen is just I see, it's almost, I am a mum and, you know, and I do have kids, and I see these adverts, I guess, for want of a better word for them, of what's going on in Yemen at the moment. And it's just absolutely heartbreaking. It must be, you know, tenfold for you, knowing that that's your, you know, where your family are from.
It's a really, really difficult one. And, like, I mean, so when the war started, so the war's been going on for about 6 years now. When the war started, it was bad, and I took it really badly. And, you know, I'm stand-up, so I remember there being a period of a few weeks, maybe months, I can't actually remember how long, where I hated the idea of getting on stage to make people laugh. And it's gonna sound really weird, I don't think I've said this out loud to anyone other than close friends, really, but it was like, I was sitting there going, I don't want you to fucking laugh. I want you to be in pain with me right now. And then it kind of like numbed. And I kept saying to myself, dude, you need to compartmentalize this. Because, I mean, the work that I do generally, like, I often see a lot of pain and I've just learned to compartmentalize it. And that's how I get on with my work, right? Because otherwise I'd be no good to anyone, including, you know, myself and the work that I'm trying to do. But I just, because it was my own family, I couldn't compartmentalize it. It took ages for me to compartmentalize it. And then I compartmentalized it. But every so often it seeps out. And so COVID hit Yemen really badly a few months back. Like, I mean, it just literally just went through the population. And it's got to the point where I actually can't tell you how many people in my circle have died. Like, that's how many. Like, it's horrible. And it was just something else. And moments like that, it just overwhelms. It just flows. And you know, at the end of the day, I'm fine. You know, I'm fine. It's my poor cousins that are, like, you know, depressed out of their minds, some of them. I mean, some of them are doing better, but, you know, some of them just aren't handling it very well at all, and you expect them to, you know? But, it's the world's worst humanitarian crisis, according to the UN, and it gets so little coverage. It's so sad.
It is sad. I mean, I've seen the videos of the children, because the children are under five, you know, a massive proportion of them are starving, you know, they're starving.
Yeah. And the problem is, if you've got kids under five, I can't remember the figure. I think it was something like young children, one in five of them, they're saying, the UN is saying they expect them to have a permanent mental or physical ailment. Because, you know, if they're hit when they're that young, it's hard. It's not like, you know, if we get hit, it's kind of like, hopefully we can just about recover, but it actually stunts growth. It's so, so sad. And I think it's really hard. I get it in some ways. It's really hard for people kind of in England or in Britain or the kind of, I don't know, Europe generally to care about somewhere which is so far, which they've never visited, they don't have a connection with. I get that. But it is the world's worst humanitarian crisis. How is it getting so little attention?
And have you been?
Yeah. I mean, I used to go regularly. I had one or two projects there. I can't go to certain places in the mainland because of my surname. So my dad's currently in exile. But other parts of the country I can go to, it's very, very high risk. And I actually do have a project on the island of Socotra, which, if I'm sure some of your listeners will.
You're going to talk about the influencer, aren't you?
Oh no, I wasn't.
I would not, because I did a little bit of online stalking about you last night, and you were really passionate about this. There was an influencer that's been living there during the times of COVID, and sort of, you know, people have been worried about her spreading her germs to the local population.
Yeah, so I think
a travel influencer.
I think it's like it. If we use it as a teachable moment, because that's maybe the best way of kind of going forward on that, it's kind of like, I've actually had people say to me recently, oh, I can't wait until, you know, like, the flights are starting up again, we're going to be going to blah, blah, blah place. And I'm like, okay, just take a deep breath for a second. Do you think that location is the best location for you to be going to? Because that is a really deprived community. They barely have any ICU beds. And there's a real risk that you or somebody on your flight might bring in COVID. So maybe don't go to that place. You know, like, if you want to go somewhere, maybe go to, I don't know, Spain, or, like, you know, like, keep to places where, you know, I mean, I had this problem. I was like, where am I going to go? I don't know how you're coping, but I was like, I'm losing my mind. I've never been in one place for so long. And for it to be London, I love London, but it's a bit, there's no nature, you know? And I was debating so many places. In the end, I ended up in the Swiss Alps. Part of my justification for it was, it's the Swiss Alps. It's one of the richest countries on the planet. I'm going to be responsible. I'm going to, like, you know, make sure I'm self-isolating once I arrive for, like, you know, however long, and, like, masking and blah, blah, blah. But yeah, it's like, and I think that's just really important for all of us in the travel world to just be thinking, all right, now that COVID's very much part of our landscape, if we go to places, you know, we probably should think three times before turning up to an indigenous area.
It's not the time to go somewhere remote, is it? Just not for our own health, which
exactly.
Obviously counts, but for other people there who will need that hospital bed if we are taking it.
And that's the thing. I think it's really difficult for some people to understand that. I think, sadly, some people in our world, it's, you know, because it's our life. This is our job, right? This is how we make our living. And for us to be, and so a lot of us are just thinking, oh, but we'll be fine. We don't care if we get a little
it's
bit
not
of a
about
flu.
You, is
exactly.
it?
exactly.
Yeah, it's back to the vaccine, really. It's not necessarily about you, but that's a whole other kind of worms. And as an interviewer, I'm sitting here thinking there's so many things I want to pull out of your conversation. I want to ask you things. Your nan from Liverpool, and then your stand-up stuff, because you are an archaeologist, an adventurer, and a stand-up comedian. But I need to get on to your... Well, you've got two really prominent TV shows out at the moment, one on Channel 4 and one on the BBC. So let's start about the Amazon adventure for Channel 4. I mean, that sounds incredible. You went viral recently with one of your discoveries. Tell us, well, where do you start with
it's
that?
It's so cool. So first of all, I have to say I am so chuffed that Channel 4 did that and gave me that opportunity, because... You know, it's a real struggle to see women in those roles. And bless, that doesn't mean there's anything wrong with our male adventurers and our male explorers.
Bless them.
Yeah, do you know what? No, genuinely.
With their nice little private school educations and white privilege. Oh, I'm taking the piss. I have them on
some
the podcast.
Some of them are mates. Sorry.
Yeah, no.
It's
not their fault they're grown up privileged.
I mean, you know, we've all got privileges.
Exactly.
I mean, well, not everyone, to be fair. I say that and I'm like very middle class, you know. I think my point is that there's absolutely nothing wrong with the boys, but there's also nothing wrong with the girls. And we know, you and I know, there's a hell of a lot of women that do this. And yet, for some reason, you ask, you know, Joe Bloggs, if we were to go out into the NHS Natural History Museum and ask Joe Bloggs, you know, can you name a single female adventurer on British or American telly? Good luck if they can name anyone, mm-hmm. you know? So that's kind of, first of all, I'm just like, just the fact that
Thanks,
happened
Channel
is
4.
Awesome.
But and the show, tell us the name of the show.
So the show is called Jungle Mystery, Lost Kingdoms of the Amazon. I would like to say I did not pick that title. I love that title because it sounds like a comic book. Anyway, basically it's this crazy thing. So we all thought of the Amazon being this pristine wilderness, basically, with just a few isolated tribes. That's always kind of the way we've thought about it. But some of the early explorers of that region said that there were these massive, like, urban environments. There were loads of indigenous people. And because the next explorers that turned up, or outsiders that turned up, were like, well, we don't see any of this, everyone kind of just assumed that those people were lying. And, I mean, they might have been. But actually, this incredible archaeological evidence is coming out that's completely shifting the way we see the Amazon. So it turns out the headline-grabbing title is that actually the Amazon isn't wilderness. The Amazon was inhabited by huge populations, in urban environments almost, of indigenous people who were importantly cultivating the Amazon. So the Amazon didn't just kind of spring up completely as it looks right now.
Someone planted it. It's a great big field where somebody's planted.
It's mad. There's actual indigenous people had gardens and orchards and like even the Brazil nut trees, they were planted. And suddenly you're like, what? But also, you know, that's interesting because it makes you think, well, hold on a second. We're not only destroying the forest, but we've also destroyed, you know, so many of the people there, because there was a 90% population crash when outsiders turned up, because, sadly, indigenous people in the Amazon didn't have immunity to outside diseases. So essentially, in this show, we go on this crazy kind of archaeological adventure where we go around four countries in the Amazon, so Brazil, Peru, Colombia, and Bolivia, and we look at all this incredible research that these archaeologists are doing, showing like site upon site upon site, these crazy discoveries. And at the same time, we're meeting all these incredible indigenous groups along the way and these tribes that are really just kind of fighting for their survival. So it's kind of a bit of a mad show. It's kind of just really unexpected, and I hope it kind of challenges the way we see the Amazon.
Describe to me the most standout moment from that trip. Describe what happened.
There were so many. There were just so many, but I think there were times when I was like very, very sad, and there were times when I was just ecstatic, and just like, oh, I can't believe I'm here, this is insane, I've just seen the most incredible, you know, rock art, or I've just seen these huge crazy structures in the landscape that these indigenous people were making. But I think actually it was usually meeting the indigenous people themselves that was pretty intense and just kind of wonderful. But also, as I said, it was really intense. At this one point, we met this one indigenous group called the Surawi, and I mean, they are in a fight for their survival. Their chief used to have armed guards with him. That's how bad it was. And he even teamed up with Google Earth at one point so he could protect their reserve and all the rest of it. And we met him because the DNA from his tribe has been really, really fascinating. And it's kind of brought up all these interesting connections and blah, blah, blah. So I was going to meet him to talk to him about this. And I meet the whole tribe, and it turns out, oh my God, it was so upsetting, it was episode two. It turns out the DNA that all of us have been using, like all these geneticists, all these scientists have been using all around the world, was taken without permission, without consent, and they are really upset about it. And they were, you know, they were kind of detailing what happened. Like, these scientists came in and just, like, took their blood and said to them, oh, we're doing this for your benefit, you'll have all these health benefits, blah, blah, blah. Nobody has even, since then, not a single scientist has contacted that indigenous, this was like over 20 years ago, has not bothered to contact them to tell them anything. And I was like, oh, crap. That's just wrong on so many levels.
And how did they, were they angry at you? How did they receive you?
It was like a mix of upset and anger at the world, I guess. They were so polite with me. I mean, you know, I guess I represented Western science to them or outside science to them, but they weren't in any way rude to me or anything. But they were just, you know, they were really hurt. The chief's mum is like 98 or something, and she's just sitting in a hammock, and she's just looking at me going, they just took it. They just took it without asking. Like, they, you know, and it's just like...
took their blood.
Oh, don't, mate, it's so twisted. And you just think, oh, my... And the thing is, that's not the only... It's interesting because I was talking to one or two genetics professors, and there was a time when that was just done. And it's still, in some places, we suspect that it's still happening, that scientists are just going in and taking blood and
that'd
just...
That'd be terrifying, because you wouldn't, you know, there's these people in that you've never seen people looking like them. They're pinning you down, they're taking, strapping something on your arm, sticking a needle in you. If you don't know what's happening, that is actually a very scary experience.
I know, and it's just, and you're not, you know, and then you're not... And the thing that shocked me was that tribe's DNA, I'm not kidding, has made headline news a number of times. And it made headline news just 2 years ago, I think it was, because of a connection with Australian Aborigines.
Oh, really? That's
so
fascinating.
You know, so any kind of nerd on the street is kind of vaguely familiar with, you know, and these guys have no idea. Nobody's told them.
Did you, how are they living? What do they live in? And what were you staying in?
Yeah, so it kind of, every tribe's really, and or indigenous group, it kind of, it depends how you want to call them, kind of, they all live very differently. So some of them are really kind of off the beaten track. Some of them are in kind of, you know, kind of the housing that you'd see in the area. Every tribe's very different. This particular group, they live in a reserve. The reserve is really clearly demarcated. It's constantly being attacked by loggers, and there's individual villages in there, and it's much more traditional. And so, you know, you've kind of got that kind of that centerpiece where it's like the whole village kind of come into the center, and it's like open. It's kind of covered, but not side covered, and everyone just is in that middle section. But, you know, honestly, I mean, there was like one indigenous group we went to, and it was so funny because the production, we all just looked at each other and were like, they've all got like huge cars. We need to be really careful about the way we portray these guys, because actually it's almost like they want it in that.
They're not wandering around in a loincloth all
the
time.
No, they're not. And it was quite funny because they did come out at one point in loincloths, and I was like, why are you doing this? And they were like, well, we want to show you this dance. and I think they thought that's what the tourists wanted. That's what we wanted to see. And it was really uncomfortable because it was like, well, if you want to show us this, by all means do. But mate, I've just seen your mop. Like, do you know what? You're clearly also very industrialised, so don't feel the need to not be who you are around us, which is very difficult when there's cameras around.
And do you portray that? Do you?
So I'm anal about this stuff. So if I see that kind of thing, I will really, really push hard for us to be more accurate about the way we portray that group.
Definitely. You want to see it how it is, and you want to tell it how it is. Otherwise, you're fabricating something rather than a journalist. I know you're technically not a journalist, but you're doing journalistic work
Exactly. I mean, you know, you are right. And I think, sadly, it's something not all television presenters understand, is we're not journalists. You know, like, journalists are amazing, and we're not that.
Well, I'm technically a journalist, but I'm only doing this, so I'm not really.
No, but travel
either.
Journalism is a definite thing, like, you know. But it's also a similar kind of fact checking, all the rest of it. But I think we do have to abide by some of those, you know, things. The problem is, of course, once something gets cut in the end. Do you know, it can end up
looking...
Yeah, you
don't have the influence over it.
Yeah, and
you?
It doesn't always look in the same... You know, I would have loved a few more... Like, in our pre-titles, that's like our promo for the whole show. I personally would have liked a few more clips of Indigenous people in kind of normal... Not normal, but kind of more...
What we see as normal
yeah,
settings.
Exactly.
Yeah, more
exactly,
Western settings, yeah. Which is a bad way of...
Yeah, no. Yeah. I know, wording is... Yeah. Stuff.
Developed words, and you're yeah. Like, no, it's all wrong, isn't it? Well, in their cars. Let's just say in their cars.
Exactly.
Like to see Indigenous people in their cars.
No, I really, really... lobbied for it hard, but and I understand it didn't, by the time it was finished, it wasn't quite working. But I think it's really, really important that, you know, if we present these kind of shows, I mean, that's such an incredible boost for me, so why would I not try to make sure that I'm doing the research and I'm trying to portray people accurately? And even then, people still get upset with me and annoyed with me, and some of those comments I'll kind of try to push back on. And some of those comments, I'm like, yeah, fair enough. Yeah, I'll take that.
So the BBC gig, tell us about that. That's another fascinating journey. So you've got these two shows coming out in the next... Yeah,
on the same,
now,
on
really.
2 days apart. Yeah. Very, 1 day apart.
They'll
very strange.
Yeah.
So basically, yeah, so that is a natural history show. And it's just... It's a natural history show set in Tanzania with Chris Packham, and basically we put a waterhole into the Tanzanian bush and just rig it with cameras and see who turns up. So it's just full of like really charismatic, gorgeous African animals, you know, just kind of those iconic species. And it feels very different to the other show. I don't know if you've seen kind of clips of both, but it's one is kind of just good old natural history escapism. Just sit there and just, I mean, I'm not kidding. Even trying to do a voiceover for that show would kill me because I'd just turn into a teenage girl because these animals are so gorgeous.
I love the way you... Oh, God, I'm going to use a long word here. I love the way you anthropomorphise them and say that they're charismatic.
They just
animals.
Are. They are. I'm sorry. I'm sure some people would be annoyed about that, but I'm like, they are just... I mean, they're so endearing.
I'm almost looking at seeing like Madagascar, you know, like with the
that's actually what
character.
I had in my, well, you know, you say that, but actually so one of the cameramen that we had on the show is Bob Poole, and his sister is Joyce Poole, who's like this really famous elephant researcher who's actually like developed the elephant dictionary.
Oh,
I'm not kidding. So she
there's an elephant dictionary.
Oh, it's amazing, right? So she's actually like deciphered all these different mannerisms and what they mean from the elephants. And it's so good that she, like, if an elephant charges her, she knows if the elephant is actually charging or if he's having fun or if he's taking, you know, and she really thinks they have a sense of humour. Like, she can tell by the
well,
different
they're just,
ways
like, freaking
they
freaking the hell out of you. I'm just going to run at this person, make them spit, but they're like,
no. She, there was one case where she was like, oh, no, that's, he's messing with us.
Wow.
Yeah.
I need her on the podcast as well, don't I?
She's amazing. She's in Kenya, though, so yeah.
I can go to Kenya. Oh, I'm not allowed.
Yeah, I mean...
the world's closed.
I mean, yeah, you might need to give it a few weeks, but yeah, no.
Gosh, so you've got so much going on, and we don't have that much time left, but I'd love to... I don't know, like, what else can I ask you about your travels? Like, where have you been?
Where have you been?
No, that's not a good story.
You know what? Because the thing is, I know right now people are going to be a bit, you know, about travel full stop. So I'll just say, in the summer, I basically relocated because I lost it. I completely lost it.
I was looking back through your social media posts and they were getting a little bit desperate. There were pictures of your garden in London. I don't think we could all relate to that.
It's so funny. It's like I ended up in a full-blown, like, long-term war with the local squirrel. I was just like, you are ruining my life and my bird feeders and all my plants. It's just absolutely hilarious. I think, and I know I'm really, really lucky to, because it's so funny, because it's kind of like, it's like how much of a privileged so-and-so can you be for you to be like, oh my god, I can't travel in the same way that I know.
I know, but we've all got, you know, our own woes and mental health issues. I'm not saying you have mental health issues, but, you know, we all had a certain amount of mental health stress over the pandemic, and we still have. And it's that old adage about some of us, we're all in the same boat. We're not all in the same boat, because some people are in dinghies without, oars, and some people are in yachts. But, it doesn't take away the fact that it is for everyone. It is personal. You know, even not being able to go out and socialise, it really affects some people.
No, 100%. But I think there is an element of just, you know, I've been so lucky, like yourself, to kind of to lead a life where I'm, you know, I'm out constantly. I mean, you know, it was getting to the point where I'm really only normally in London for about a week or two a month, so it's kind of, you know, I really am just kind of out a lot, and suddenly all my TV shows got cancelled, and suddenly all my travel became unethical, to put it bluntly, you know. And so I was like, crap, you know, even my expeditions got cancelled, like everything just went out the window. And it was kind of in the summer, as we were coming out of lockdown, I looked at my housemate and went, you know what, I don't think I'm going to make a second lockdown, because I knew there was going to be a second lockdown. We all kind of, like, unless we were deluding ourselves, we all knew there was going to be a second lockdown.
And possibly even a third.
Yeah, really. Yeah, this is the thing. And I was like, I don't think I can handle a second lockdown if I don't leave. Like, and I think partly that was my mental health, in the sense that London is too, there's no green spaces. And I keep saying this, we know scientifically, the data is overwhelming, that green spaces really do wonders for our mental health. And cities are wonderful, but we weren't designed for them. You know, we haven't evolved for them.
It's funny, because I always argue about London being one of the greenest cities I know, but I suppose it depends where you live. And I was living here up until 3 months ago, and I was near Greenwich Park and the river, so it's probably slightly different.
No, I mean, 100%, it's just that I'm talking like proper just green, you know, just like constantly.
Yeah, you're right here. You've been at the remote. I'm used to Greenwich Park. You've been trekking in the Amazon. I suppose it's a little bit different.
I'm just like, it needs to be real wilderness. There needs to be no farming anywhere nearby. No,
we don't have that much wilderness in London or
the UK. I think we're quite, you know, we're quite
Scotland
managed.
Possibly.
Yeah, Scotland's amazing. No, so I ended up in the Swiss Alps. So I ended up there for like 2 months. It's this. So everybody kind of knows that French, German, and Italian are spoken in Switzerland. What a lot of people don't know is there's this fourth language called Romanish, which is basically like Latin, and that's spoken just in this one enclave. And so it just...
A way to make it difficult for yourself.
I know. Well, actually, think about it. It's perfect, because suddenly I'm like, I literally can't speak any language that... But it was just, and it's just such an incredible part of the world. But also Switzerland, I feel, is just a caricature of itself.
It is beautiful. It is. Yeah. It's like a chocolate box, isn't it?
It's mad.
But then it's got the random, I've spent quite a lot of time in Switzerland, but then it's the gun issue is like kind of, you don't expect the gun issue.
It is strange, because I was like, you know, going on my daily hikes, and my mate in the neighbouring hamlet, because that is literally what we were dealing with, neighbouring hamlets, was like, you're not going out in that, are you? And I was like, I was just like, Ella, it's hunting season, you need to be wearing red. And I was just trying to adjust my head for like, oh, Europe, hunting season, what, huh? Because it's not something we normally think about.
What do you mean you need to be wearing red? To stand out so you don't get shot?
Yeah, so normally I'm just in like North Face, like, do you know what I mean? Just like dark kind of like whatever colours, you know? But suddenly that's actually quite dangerous if you're going on a walk in the middle of the Swiss Alps in hunting season. Because she's like, look, some of these hunters are kind of... You know, they're drinking, they're all just... She's like, every year we have a number of reported incidents. She's like, you need to wear red. And I was like, oh. It's just really funny. It's like, oh, okay, I really wasn't expecting this. So I'm not used to guns in this. Anywhere near home.
No, you're used to guns in far-flung places.
No.
Briefly then, gosh, tell me about your stand-up career, because you're also an archaeologist and a stand-up.
Yeah, that's just, I needed to do that for myself. I think some of the places I go are a bit dark. It can be a bit dark. I mean, they're wonderful, but they can be dark. And I just needed to laugh again, you know? And it's just, it's a really, really good way of doing things. But also it's a great way of communicating science. It's a great way of communicating politics and different things. And I don't think I would have the tele jobs that I've got if it wasn't... Because it's, you know, it's so difficult to get some of those things if it wasn't for the fact that people were like, oh, you know what, she's an adventurer, she's a scientist, she works in hostile places, and she's a comic. Do you know what? Like, I think there's an element of going, all right, let's give her a go.
We've got to see what she's like.
Yeah, because she might be able to handle, you know, because there is a bravado that's almost needed. And I hate it. You know, it doesn't bring out the best in you sometimes, but it's almost needed for television. So I think it stood me in good stead, I have to say. And it's just...
You must have like a tremendous amount of confidence, I think, because I go on TV and radio, but I'm terrified of public speaking.
Yeah.
So the thought of getting up in front of an audience that, you know, can be quite hostile at times, and telling jokes, like, terrifies the hell out of me.
Yeah, and it's just you up there. It's not like sketch or anything else. It's like, it's just you. So you... The success is all yours and the failure is all yours. And you fail, do you know what I mean? You are used to dying that... You know, I did Edinburgh, not during COVID, but the Edinburgh Fringe just the year before COVID. And it's like, you know, you just sit there and you're like, it just literally sometimes the exact same material the very next day in exactly the same time slot received completely differently. And you got to get used to it. It's just like...
It's going to happen.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you just accept that you might die some days.
I think, you know, I draw parallels between your adventuring and stand-up comedy. I can see that it's not such a great leap from one to the other.
Yeah, you're not the only one that said that. It's like, would you rather die on stage or at the hands of a terrorist? I need you to think about that.
Can I make the terrorist laugh first?
But that would be, could you imagine? You know, you get these stories of like making somebody fall in love with it.
Like sort of, what's it? A Stockholm syndrome.
Yeah. But instead, I just perform really well.
Yeah. Or just perform badly, they'll let you out early. It's like, we're not kidnapping her. Jesus Christ.
So, well, can I turn it around and ask, what are you planning to do? Like, you know, because you're part of the same world. Do you have any sense of what your next trip would be like?
You're asking me?
Yeah, because I think...
Yeah, but I'm not part of the same world. I'm a traveller. I've travelled lots, but my travelling has been holidays.
You know, you are part of this world. I mean, what? Sorry. Yeah. Because I'm not talking about telly and kind of non-telly. I'm talking about just kind of those of us who rely on the outdoors and it kind of really comes into our work and it is part of our work. I feel like as a community we're all a bit lost right now. So that's why I'm saying, and so you.
I felt trapped, but it's funny how that entrapment has changed things around. And we were saying that, you know, today is the first day we've actually seen people, and we're here in the Natural History Museum, we're in London, and I was very miserable and found it a real struggle, particularly with my family are in Spain, and I go to Spain a lot. I've got a place there, I grew up there, I love the lifestyle, and it's home for me, it's my escape, it's my sanctuary, and I used to just getting on a plane and hopping over there. Yeah. And having that taken away has been really hard. However, it's changed my perspective, and I don't know if you're finding this. Do you know how excited I was to get on a train today, to get on the tube for my first time since March? And bearing in mind, up until July, I lived in London full time and had been here for years and years.
Yeah.
To get on a tube, to look and see there's a cafe open down the road. After this, I'm going to find a pub that'll let me in, or I might have to stand outside. I'm going to see some shops. I'm going to see... London, and it's really turned, so it has almost in a way, and I don't know if anyone else can relate to this, that sort of narrowing of my horizons has made me just appreciate the little things so much more.
Oh, that's really sweet. It just made me a bit warm and a little bit goosebumpy. I think so. I think it's like, it's interesting because I feel like quite a few of us are going, oh, we're going to do this, you know, this is going to be our next dream one and we just can't wait to do it. But actually I do find some people as well are saying exactly what you've said, which is, oh my God, I'm just appreciating the little things again. Like, just grateful. And in some ways, I think your attitude is much better.
It's not something I'm choosing to do. It's just happened to me. And do you know how much it's going to be, you know, I'm going to eat in a restaurant tonight. And do you know how much of an adventure that is going to be to eat in a restaurant?
A substantial meal in a restaurant.
Not even a Scotch egg, Ella. I haven't eatten meat for 20 years, but sod it, I'd have a Scotch egg to get me into a pub. Give me the pig, you know, sorry, piggy. Anyway, I should ask you my last question so I can get to the pub.
Sorry.
We're not running out of time at all. No, we are. But my last question is always about music, and because I think music and travel go very much hand in hand. So I'm going to ask you to choose one song that reminds you of a memorable time or place of travel? And what is that song and what is the memory? Why are you remembering it?
No,
it's a goodie, isn't it?
It is. Oh, man. Your listeners are going to judge me. Okay. So, I started listening to a lot of Lizzo. And I started listening to it because my professional life was going amazingly well. And I started to realise certain things about my private life. Yeah. So, reading between the lines, I just started dating somebody who's wonderful and starting to realise the extent of damage of another ex. And I was listening to Lizzo and I was travelling at the same time. And it was kind of this shift in my personal life. And it was so funny because I feel like the whole of my career, and people at the outside see this, I don't, you know, for me it's a constant bloody struggle, but people are like, oh, it's going amazing. And, you know, like this week, people are like, hold on a second, you've got two major shows on UK channels this Christmas. And I'm like, yeah, I guess I do. And it all looks great. But my personal life, I guess, I hadn't quite, you know, I wasn't taking that same kind of respect for myself, you know, and kind of whatever. And so suddenly it just, that power in that voice with that travel, like through the Amazon or with that travel in Tanzania, because I was just listening to it on repeat, her kind of, her songs on repeat. It's a weird one to say, but I don't know if that music is usually taken on its own. And in this particular case, it was like a mix of music, travel, and realigning kind of my attitude to my professional life and my attitude towards my personal life.
Yeah. And I love it that travel and music has that power.
Yeah, 100%.
Funny enough, I had Leveson Wood on the podcast and I remember asking him, he spoke, I don't know what his status is now, this is like maybe 18 months ago, but at the time he was saying that how he's sort of neglected his personal life because of all the travels. And I think I kind of proposed to him, but I was married at the time myself, so you know, I'm single now, I should give him a call.
Well, it's funny, I think, so I too am single right now, and it's kind of like, it's the worst time to be single. It's so funny, the amount of times where I was like, God's sake, I should have like thought this through before like going into a pandemic single. But no, I think it's a funny one how a lot of us just, I think we just prioritise other stuff. But I don't know if it is that. I think we just travel too much, so we're not around, you know, we're not loitering enough.
You should maybe give Leveson Wood a call. He's an attractive guy.
I don't think we'd quite. Like, we're chummy. We're very chummy. But no, I was going to say, actually, when I was in the Swiss Alps, this is to hit home with the problem with a lot of us in this world, I turned around to my mate and I was like, but there's just no men here. And my mate was like, you think you've decided to spend 2 months in the middle of a village in the Swiss Alps with nobody under the age of 60, Ella? What did you expect would happen? And I was like, yeah, I guess you do have a point.
And then, unless you're wearing reds, they might shoot you.
To be fair, some of the hunters were very handsome. I was like, oh.
All right, next holiday lined up. Ella, thank you so much for coming on the Big Travel Podcast. Oh,
thank you. Thank you so much, mate.
Thank you so much for being the best listeners, and Ella for being a wonderful face-to-face interview. The Big Travel Podcast will be back very soon with the Christmas special with a whole host of wonderful guests for you.